You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to introduce this evening's special event. It's exploring critical issues linking architecture, faith, and community. At a time when society is increasingly divided in all sorts of ways, we've brought together an expert panel to help us explore the potential of shared spaces and values to foster community cohesion and collaboration. It's been an event I've been looking forward to for ages, partly because two of the buildings that have had the most profound effect on me are the Hagia Sophia and the Mesquita at Cordoba, which are both buildings that have an amazing interfaith and also conflict between faith imprinted on them in the most incredibly powerful way. So it's a fascinating topic. We're delighted to welcome Chairman John McCaslin and Design Director Aidan Potter of the award-winning architectural firm John McCaslin and Partners. The practice has an emphasis on contemporary design for a changing world and has been involved in a number of faith projects. John and Aidan will speak about the evolving design, role and function of places of worship at the heart of increasingly diverse communities. I'm also pleased to introduce distinguished contributors, the Reverend the Lord Griffiths, a superintendent minister at Wesley's Chapel, and Sophia D'Souza, Chief Executive of the Glasshouse Community-Led Design. Leslie Griffiths will bring the insights into the role of faith communities in meeting the needs of societies, and Sophia will explore connections between design, people, and place. And when we've heard from them, if you're not completely intimidated by their brilliance and expertise, I will invite your comments and questions. So I think we're going to have a fascinating hour, and without further ado, please join me in welcoming John McCaslin.
Good evening. So I've got 12,000 years of religious architecture in 12 minutes. So over the years, our practice has responded to a diverse set of challenges facing communities all over the world. In Kigali, Rwanda, at the Genocide Memorial Site, in Kenya with the rebuilding of a community cathedral west of Nairobi, and in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, following the devastating earthquake in 2010. By rebuilding the city's historic market hall and gathering place. These projects illustrate our commitment to working with communities with the chosen faith and way of life, which my colleague Aidan Potter will discuss shortly. So what do we mean by the architecture of faith? And what is it that churches, temples, mosques, synagogues and other places of worship offer us in the fast-paced, ever-changing and complex world that we live in? My introduction this evening will touch on these issues and highlight examples of how the design of places of worship have evolved over time to serve a broad spectrum of communities. It's difficult to overstate the significance of faith architecture, for it dates back thousands of years, as illustrated from a 12,000-year-old religious site here in Anatolia. And today serves in descending order some 2.2 billion Christians, 1.6 billion followers of Islam, a billion Hindus, and 500 million Buddhists, roughly three quarters of the world's people. Less populated religions include, of course, Judaism, whose 16 million followers are spread across 120 countries, from 6 million in Israel to 36 in Bahrain. And the synagogue here in Cochin, the oldest in the Commonwealth, which has a congregation of 26. Historically, faith architecture defined communities. For centuries in England, for example, it was a dominating presence in people's lives, thoughts, and behaviours. In the Hindu faith, worship, meditation, and family-based rites of passage have been central to daily life for over 2,500 years. And in the Islamic world, domestic and faith architecture share the same courtyard built forms that date back to the 7th century. Today, in the increasingly secular and virtualized age, it seems significant to me that most people, even non-believers, continue to respect and value places of worship. So why is this? Well, surely, it's because not only do these spiritual places offer solace and emotional connections, but they are always, always the most permanent, symbolic, and expressive of buildings. Suleimani Mosque, the Byzantine and Islamic blend designed by the great Ottoman architect Sinan. Two millennia ago, places of worship were the absolute nuclei of their communities. Today, in much of the developed world, the reverse seems to be the case, with public culture dictating the terms of the relationship between places of worship and the societies that they serve. The cultural shift, or this cultural shift, has seen a remarkable evolution in terms of faith architecture. And here are three examples from the post-war period which demonstrate that modernist architecture, even brutalist architecture, can serve the needs of the architecture of faith. On the left is Eero Saarinen's glorious non-denominational chapel at MIT in Cambridge, Mass. In the middle, the multi-faith Air Force Cadet Chapel in Colorado Springs by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And on the right, the powerful aesthetic of St. Bride's Roman Catholic Church in East Kilbride by the Scottish architects Gillespie, Kidd and Coya. By contrast, the recent evangelical megachurch at Saddleback in California on the left and the Watermark Community Church in Dallas on the right are more conference hall aesthetic than places to pray, whilst the architecture of the vast Sheikh Zayed Mosque in Abu Dhabi incorporates traditional Islamic symbols from many sources in its campus of faith. It's important to remember, though, that these grandiose schemes that we've just seen don't necessarily reflect the typical contemporary faith condition. For instance, here is the beautiful Bruder Klaus Chapel in rural Germany, designed by the Swiss architect Peter Zumthor in 2007 and hand-built by local farmers. If you can look this up, it's an amazing story of the construction of this church, which is worth looking at. And on the Thai-Burmese border, Kukuma Watanabe's recent multi-faith project unites a Buddhist prayer space with an educational and community hub for its refugee congregation. And in terms of multifunctional and multi-faith buildings, for which I have a particular passion, this is our teaching building in rural Malawi. Initially programmed as an infant school, this modest brick and timber structure is also used for adult learning, as a community health space, and as a non-denominational place for prayer. And a building I know well, perched on the east side of the A11 Autostrada, just north of Florence and next to petrol stations and motels, is the extraordinary San Giovanni Battista Church, designed by Giovanni Michelucci. Built in the early 1960s to honour the workers who died building the autostrada itself, this majestic concrete, stone and copper roof structure continues to have a very particular resonance for its community and those who drive by. Sometimes a private and personal vision inspires a place of worship, drawing a much wider, not necessarily religious, community to its midst. For instance, in Arkansas, Faye Jones' exquisite Thorn Crown Chapel from 1980 was commissioned by a retired teacher and built on a forested hillside. Its wonderful filigree timber interior welcomes some 2,000 visitors a day. And I think a particular favourite of Aidan and mine. Whilst on an even more intimate scale is the Irish architect Neil McLaughlin's elliptical and very beautiful Bishop Edward King Chapel near Oxford, flooded with gorgeous light. And in Copenhagen, one significantly scaled Lutheran church embodies the idea of faith and community as a single design tableau. For here, the Gothic plan and the expressionist brickwork of Grundtvig Church, designed by Peder Jensen Klint in 1927, was built using 6 million bricks, which were also used to construct the community around it. And how many small towns, I wonder, would be bold enough to commission such a radical design as Gottfried Baum's brutalist pilgrimage church near Dusseldorf? Completed in 1968, this structure is considered to be the Pritzker Prize winner's greatest work, challenging in its architecture and its reflection of faith. The relationship between faith and those who have built their places of worship is ever-changing. In the Middle Ages, sizable workforces of cathedral building joiners and stonemasons became embedded in communities over long periods of time. The magnificent Ely Cathedral has Romanesque segments, a porch in the Gothic style, and a 14th century octagonal tower, which means the cathedral was in a permanent state of construction for hundreds of years. a physical reminder of the endurance of a community's faith. And in Barcelona, Antonio Gaudí's Sagrada Familia is an ongoing example of this type of evolving commitment to a place of worship. Begun in 1882 and pausing only briefly following Gaudí's untimely death in 1926, its construction is expected to be complete in 2026, some 144 years after its groundbreaking. The architecture is symbolic of both Catholic worship and the independent spirit of Barcelona and Catalonian communities. And as an aside, yesterday, a good friend of ours, Irvine Seller, passed away. He was a wonderful developer, built the Shard. And it's interesting to know the Shard. If you think of the height of the Shard, when fully built, the Sagrada Familia will be about four-fifths of the height of the Shard. So scale will be extraordinary. I knew that Irvine some way had to fit into this. A significant role for faith architecture is to serve communities who have suffered natural disasters or those who are impoverished or marginalised, providing places for both physical security as well as religious sanctuary. In 1986, for example, an avalanche spread through the village of Monnu in Switzerland. Part of the response to the destruction was the building a decade later of this church, designed by the Swiss master architect Mario Botta, a bold architectural statement of its community's endurance. In New Zealand, Shugura Ban's so-called cardboard cathedral on the left embodies a temporary worship space following the city's 2011 earthquake, whilst the same year on the right, our proposed temporary place of worship was set within the ruins of the Cathedral of Our Lady of Assumption in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And in Ulm, Germany, the architects KSG placed the city's new synagogue a stone's throw from its former location, destroyed during Kristallnacht, with this new synagogue reclaiming its former central location. And finally, in London, our project to rebuild the modern mosque is rooted in the ambitions and leadership of this community, which suffered the destruction of its beloved mosque, gutted by fire in 2015. Within 1 week of the fire, its determined congregation was holding services within its remaining elements, which, when rebuilt, will return as Western Europe's largest Islamic place of worship. The architect's role in the architecture of faith is a complex one, creating spaces that offer a safe haven to emotion, to memory, and to religious connections between places and peoples, no matter what their circumstances, commanding empathy and practicality in equal measure. I'll leave you with a final thought. Will worshippers continue to depend on faith architecture as their physical place of worship? More and more people of all faiths in all parts of the world are leading lives that are increasingly personalised and screen-based. Snapchat, although I have to say not me, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Google. There are already websites called thevirtualchurch.com and airjesus.com. The Diocese of Oxford has started something called the iChurch. In 10 or 20 years' time, how many people will be worshipping on screen in the digitally imaged place of their choice? York Minster, Mecca, Angkor Wat, or the Urva Synagogue? Or is there something about the architectures of faith and the actual rather than the virtual gathering of worshippers that cannot be eroded? Thank you.
Good evening. I have a slightly less ambitious ambit. I'll probably only deal with 5 years of a series of projects that the practice has been involved in. And I suppose the point I'll try and make is that each of these projects are very different, very distinct, both nationally and internationally. All of them, I think, evidence the continuing relevance of architecture of faith. But perhaps all of them show that perhaps the architectural model needs to change a little bit more rapidly to accommodate a rapidly changing environment, as John has alluded to, in terms of people's aspirations and needs for faith. First illustration is our cathedral in Carriccio. And as a Catholic and as an architect, very properly the opportunity to be involved in the participate in the delivery of a cathedral is absolutely a highlight to one's career. But actually, a cathedral is the work of many hands, and as our client often told me, it is the work of an invisible hand, and that's undoubtedly an important dynamic as an architect in the engagement of faith architecture, that there is a concern and interest in an inspiration that in some regards is beyond yourself. The cathedral, whilst it is a Roman Catholic cathedral, Kenya is a country of 7.5 million Catholics, a third of the population. The cathedral seats 1,200 people, 1,500 people at a push, and every Sunday this cathedral runs three services which are completely full. So comparisons with the practice of Catholicism that I'm aware of and I know in this country, whilst interesting, pale into insignificance in terms of the intensity and the simplicity of the faith in Africa. So it is dangerous, well, not dangerous, but it is not sometimes helpful to make allusions between the practice of a similar faith in different contexts. The context changes the faith and the practice of the faith in profound terms. Interestingly, at the same time, exactly the same time, the practice was also delivering and developing proposals for the mosque in Doha, in the Mushareb in Doha. And again, an ambitious project right at the heart of probably one of the world's largest and most ambitious urban quarters. And I suppose what's particularly interesting about the mosque, not just as a piece of architecture, was the determination to actually signify and place a building, a significant building of religious assembly, at the very heart of urban development. And I think actually that is something that we're in danger of losing as we increasingly develop our cities and actually lose a contact with the placement and sanctity of churches and mosques and places of worship as significant moments in our cities. At a slightly more modest scale, but nonetheless a fascinating and important project dealing with the rediscovery and the reuse, adaptive reuse of an important, a very important chapel, John Wesley's chapel on the City Road, and the extension of the Museum of Methodism within the chapel. And in this country, of course, a lot of faith architecture very properly is concerned with the sensitive and adaptive reuse of historic buildings, which is very much the context that we find ourselves in. And in that exact same context, and at the same time, a remarkable project to actually look at the adaptation of the great room in the Friends Meeting House in the centre of the Quakers, a building you all probably know, opposite Euston Station. And here, a project that was concerned to extend and exploit and introduce flexibility into the use of the major space. And I think the opportunities to actually extend the use of historic places of worship and offer more flexible use for those to extend their use is also a recurrent theme of our work, definitely in this country. And sadly, in a funny sort of way, the last project of this suite was our adaptation of a deconsecrated church and finding sustainable futures for an extraordinary range of churches which have fallen into disuse, being properly respectful of these churches. This is the church St. James's at Hatcham, its conversion to educational use for the Goldsmiths College. Again, I think is an important dynamic, an obligation we all have to the legacy of these important buildings in terms of national identity. Now, architecture is a moral activity. John and I were certainly educated by a generation of architects after the war who absolutely believed that architecture was a social art. And indeed, I think, as many architects do, we often talk about our buildings in moral terms. We talk about honesty of materials and the integrity of the building itself. Pugin was the origin of this idea. He introduced the moral imperative. And, of course, his grand vision of a new Jerusalem where the modern industrial city would be properly balanced with a responsible adaptation and development of religious architecture is, in a way, a kind of a sad vision, because I suppose that particular vision in specific terms was never realised. But nonetheless, the placement of ecclesiastical architecture at the very heart and centre of all the cities that we live in historically is a context that we all completely understand. I think perhaps one of the interesting issues that we may talk about later is the fact that the logical placement and identity of places of worship and the integration of places of worship into our cities is something we're losing in terms of a disconnection with faith and community in literal terms, in terms of its registration into our developing cities. We certainly do need to look at the exploitation and extension of existing and new buildings of faith to actually exploit and look at all sorts of creative opportunities to introduce new uses, multiple new uses into existing buildings to create sustainable futures, real sustainable futures for a collection of buildings which are in many regards at peril in this country. It's a significant and important issue that all architects and faith institutions have to address. In some regards, in many regards, and certainly in my faith, it is quite difficult to find the balance between the development of a modern church that is properly respectful to the format and the historic legacy and the procedures and routines of a faith, and also updating it to adapt it to new uses. This slide shows the adaptation of the plan of our cathedral at Carriccio. And you can see that we moved away from the Latin cross, and it really was a response to the bishop's Bishop Emmanuel's desire to actually extend and improve the interface of the congregation with the act of communion and to change the format but also retain a legible connection with 2,000 years of history. So finding a balance between making some changes but also respecting the legacy of 2,000, often more, years of continuity of worship is a particular issue that we faced a number of times. As John mentioned, we are very much in a remarkable time. It's often been termed as a 21st century reformation, an extraordinary change in the practice of faith, in the denomination and the plurality of faith, particularly in this country. And also very interesting new models in which, I don't know if any of you have actually been to the Hillsong sermons at the Dominion Theatre, but again, an extraordinary event in which an evangelical group practices faith to a huge audience in a completely different format, in a very unusual format, and who's to say that isn't relevant and important, and finding new models and adapting new models to the new ways and expectations that generations have for faith is a particular challenge that we do all faith. We all change. I will leave you with a moral paradox. It's a paradox that I feel very strongly as a Catholic. Undoubtedly, these marvellous buildings that we've had the pleasure and significance of developing, often internationally and nationally, are expensive buildings. Just the surface area, the size. And although faith isn't about expense, undoubtedly, the expenditure of a relatively dwindling resource in creating buildings to the glory and honour of the Lord is an interesting challenge. But there are other models. There are other interesting models for a church. And again, this is a church. This is a church established in Tottenham, on an industrial estate in Tottenham, the High Road to Holiness. And this is a church that offers refuge and succour to homeless people. And the only thing that shows you it's a church is that little piece of plastic on the wall. But actually, within this small series of rooms, there is refuge, warmth, support and comfort for homeless people in Tottenham. It's a very, very real and totally important obligation that that particular church actually manages to administer. So whatever future faith architecture has in the community, I think it must be centred on and properly attentive to the real concerns of those who are less privileged than all of us in terms of offering possible futures. And I think if the dear Lord was with us today, and I'm sure he is with us in every regard, I think he'd be less concerned about the buildings in his name and more concerned about the poor people on the steps. Thank you very much.
Leslie, over to you.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak to this august gathering and particularly to bounce any ideas I have off the splendid presentations that we've just had that have looked at the physical space that architects can design and cater for worshipping communities. I will be looking, of course, at the communities rather than the envelopes which encase their practices and their comings together. Perhaps that's the right place to start. What a wonderful array of modern responses to the prevailing, against the evidence sometimes, need for a faith dimension in social life, not just in developing countries, but here too. It's a stubborn manifestation that refuses to go away. And of course, across the ages, architects have responded in with materials and with ideas that were appropriate to the age in which they gave expression to those ideas. The challenge for architects, people who deal with a physical environment, it's manifold. First of all, if you look at Coventry Cathedral and the interplay between Basil Spence and the cathedral chapter, you have the dialectic that matters most. The client is always going to pay the bills and will have a significant voice. The architect will have an idea that he desperately would love to prevail, and sometimes compromises are necessary, which are either satisfactory or definitely not satisfactory. The danger is always that the physical space will contribute an envelope, an enclosed space within which faith is to be practiced, and in some way imprison an idea that's yearning for fresh air. Certainly in times of religious retreat, as we are experiencing here just at the minute, that's a very real danger, that somewhere to retreat to, a redoubt of high walls, must be resisted. Of course, that's not just down to the architect, it's down to the leadership of the community itself. But that's one danger. An embattled community will look to its home as its castle and draw up the drawbridge when it's inside, sing some nice hymns to get a good feel about things, and then go out and face the nasty world cheered up by what's happened inside. The other danger, it seems to me, is the roof. The space has to be covered, of course, especially in inclement climates like this. But you have to get the balance between safe space for people to say their prayers, to sing their hymns, to seek inspiration, to encourage each other. That's what it's all about, really. In a space that is definable, at the same time creating the impression that there is no roof, because all that happens, if it's real, is sub specie aeternitatis. It's true to something that is seen by the eye of God himself. Now, in the days when you could count on Gothic to provide perpendicularity, you got the sense of the upward soaring of the spirit in that kind of space. Now that that's no longer what happens on the whole, you have to achieve that, or aim to achieve that, even though your ceilings are a little bit lower, your thresholds should be a bit bigger. So you have a challenge as architects. I'm not an architect. I'm delighted I'm not an architect. But let me just tell you from the world of theology how we theologians have over the centuries, with our words and our philosophizing and our formulaic responses to faith, built equally formidable constructions within which faith has had a good chance to die. Actually, faith, if it's real, needs fresh air. And buildings should create a sense of air that can be breathed and relationships that can be developed and freedoms that can be enjoyed and security that can be experienced, all of that within a space that is still within four walls, as well as the upward thing, of course. Now, what I've chosen to do, because clearly I'd liked to be the typical Methodist minister who has accomplished the art of speaking in Fidel Castro-length utterances. I must try and do it in 7 minutes, is suggest that perhaps the eye might be off the ball if we stuck to the idea of the built environment, because that isn't, on the whole, where interesting and lively forms of religious practice are being experienced. What do I mean by that? Well, pilgrimages are popular, very popular, just at the moment. Not just Compostela and Walsingham and all kinds of places, even at Wesley's Chapel. We just walk from St. Paul's Cathedral to the chapel every 24th of May, our patronal festival. And solvitur ambulando, all kinds of things get settled in the mind whilst you're on the march. That sitting there week after week doesn't always do it. And just getting the rain on you and braving the elements and daring to show your faith in public is a real extra ingredient. High-octane Christianity. Kids love pilgrimages. They'll go on gap years with their backpacks and so on and attempt great pilgrimages, the walks that have been traditionally done over the centuries. I remember I had a good friendship with Cardinal Hume whilst he was alive, and I remember him telling me how every year he would go with 12 busfuls of students from London University to Lourdes. And the excitement of the young people was palpable. And the experience was magnificent. And the fellowship was brilliant. And as soon as they got off the bus in London again, he knew that those kids would not go to church again for another year. And somehow we must subscribe to the idea that we're living in an age that, whilst it continues to believe stubbornly, persistently, contraindicatively, it does not want to believe in a sense that demands that it belongs. Believing, not necessarily belonging. Which leads me to think that we need fewer churches with better liturgies and better opportunities and facilities rather than just perpetuating all kinds of things. Now, the other area where this kind of thing is on display is retreats. People love going to a monastery for a few days of silence. St. Bino's in North Wales, or the great thing that was on television down in the south of England. All these places command an attention, a one-off, a break from the routine, meeting people you haven't met before. All of that is a challenge, some of it intimidating, but there's a great popularity for it. There's a national retreat movement that puts together in a catalogue fashion all the places that have great history, wonderful architecture, are in secluded and beautiful places, and they are very attractive, especially since they've added ensuite rooms. And then how do you explain this extraordinary phenomenon I picked up from the Church Times just the other week? Architects bid to design monument to prayer. Under the aegis of the Royal Institute of British Architects, a competition's been set up. Somebody's put up the money, 1 million bricks, to build a monument to answered prayer, taking inspiration from the Angel of the North, wanting alongside a motorway to put up some phenomenal thing with a little chapel and a visitor centre that will remind people that prayer is, in people's experience, answered, and people feel blessed. And this will be a monument to that. And five have been shortlisted, three from Britain, one from Denmark, and one from Italy, with rather intriguing designs, I have to say. A bona fide kosher under the aegis of all those who know about architecture, that's the RIBA, we know that only they know about architecture, it is a competition underway, and we wait to see the results of that. But once again, monuments, significant places, inspirational monuments to attract the attention and to inspire. And then how on earth would you explain the phenomenon of tese in France, in Burgundy. I used to go there quite a lot and teach the members of the monastic community there English literature. They were particularly fond of Gerard Manley Hopkins, who, of course, himself was a Jesuit and associated with St. Bino's, now a retreat centre. But translating Hopkins into French is virtually impossible. And actually, Taizé is virtually impossible. But a Swiss pastor after the Second World War, horrified at the happenings of the Second World War, built his little establishment just across the border between Germany and France in order that people from Germany and France should find refuge in the same place. Brother Roger Schutz, whom I knew quite well until he was assassinated not too long ago, was insistent that he would not have a fine building. He deliberately got himself organized within sight of Cluny, the biggest monastery of the Middle Ages and the mother monastery for an imperializing network of monasteries across Europe. Never again would he want to go down that road with its triumphalism and its power lust. So he built this thing they worship in a hangar. Well, even that's a grand title for it. Its prevailing quality is darkness. Because the one thing you don't want to do when you go inside is see anything, especially if Catholics and Protestants are there. When you go for communion, you don't know which line you're in. And Pope John XXIII called it a little springtime for the church. And so you have hundreds of thousands of young people in their 20s and 30s gathering there every single summer. How do you explain that, other than on the basis of a fine and lovely grand place for people to meet in? It's the opposite of that. And so we're trying to grasp something by its tail. For me, the finest and the simplest ideas in life. I mean, I've just come back from India. In Kerala, I was at the top of a mountain. Everything was just phenomenally beautiful. And what I wanted to do was bottle it and bring it back with me. And I knew that once it was bottled, it was dead. When I was a lepidopterist as a child, I loved the butterflies. But when they were on display in my cabinet, they were no longer alive. The challenge is to create a space within which things can live and breathe and flourish. That's it.
Last but by no means least, Sophia.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to talk this evening about the lived experience of places of worship. We've talked about how they're created. We've talked about how we interact with faith. But this evening, I'd like to explore what happens when people are inhabiting these spaces, when they have to look after these spaces, and when they need to adapt them to new needs. The landscape of religious buildings is incredibly complex, and our relationship with them as well. Whether we step into a faith building, which is from our faith practice or another's, we cross a threshold and we step into a different space. Different religious beliefs bring with them different types of buildings and different liturgy of space, different sacredness of space. But what they all share is that they have spaces that have been created to bring a community together, to practice their faith together. But just as each of us belongs to a number of different communities, where we live, where we work, our children's school community, our faith community, our communities of shared interests, so do places of worship have a number of different communities around them. And what I'd like to look at is that relationship between the community of faith attached to a religious building and to the local community around them. It's a time at the moment where community spaces are under threat. There's less funding available. Community centres are being closed down. And these places of worship that have sat for centuries as the centre of community life suddenly have both a new opportunity and a new challenge. How do they open their doors to those not just who practice a faith there, but to become community hubs as they were originally conceived? How do they become spaces that can be shared by people of different faith groups or people who don't practice faith at all, but who need a space in which to gather and come together with their community? I'd like to look specifically at a couple of projects that we've worked with through a project we're involved in called Empowering Design Practices. And it's just a couple of examples that show the different approach, the ways in, if you like, to rethinking how a space can work. And in particular, I'd like to look at the power of design to transform these spaces, but not design only in the hands of architects, but also in the hands of people rethinking and reimagining their spaces and working with architects to do that. This is a church in Oxfordshire. It's quite a small church, and it sat there for approximately, in some shape or form, for approximately 900 years. It's in a village that recently decided they needed a new village hall. And as part of the Millennium funding streams, there was an opportunity to conceive a new building and to get it built, but it never really happened. And the community came together and said, well, do we really need a new community building? Isn't there a building here that we could repurpose or use or share? And they got together with the church, the parish council and the church and local community members, and they thought, well, let's turn this lovely church into both our church and our village hall. And one of my favourite anecdotes about this place is that half the village refer to it as the church and half of the village refer to it as the village hall. But to make that possible, they had to make some changes. It was a building that had no services, no running water, no toilets, no kitchen, and frankly was a bit cold and damp and not suitable for many spaces. So they came together and they made a few changes. And they did those really taking into account the importance of good design. You can see here one of the things that they did was remove the pews to create a flexible space. Many of you will know that pews come with a lot of baggage in terms of how people feel about them, whether they should stay or leave. But one of the great things about this particular church is that they made the decision to remove the pews. They made them available to people in the community if they wanted them. But they created a space that was flexible. And you can see that they brought design features very carefully into these changes. You'll notice that on the tiling work around the font is actually from the flooring that was taken out. They built a beautiful little passage through to an extension for the toilets, very sensitively built, but also bringing in local craftsmen to do the work. And this is what happens there now. There are parties, children's groups, Pilates, lunch clubs, workshops. They even have a cinema club there. You can see in that picture over there, they have a screen that comes down, and they have a cinema club there. And all of this was done by local people coming together and saying, well, you know, what can this building be to us? And how can we use it and make it multifunctional but protect the faith practice that happens there? And I had a wonderful conversation with the vicar who, and just coming back to this font, moving the font from its previous position means two things. One, that when the bride celebrating her wedding steps through the door with her father or whoever it might be accompanying her, they don't need to separate to go around the font or do this to go around the font. They simply walk down the aisle. But also, in serious terms around the quality of faith practices that can happen there, the vicar said to me, well, actually, moving the font and removing the pews has allowed me to do different types of services. I can do a christening there in a much more intimate setting around the font. It's a small part of the church that can create a very intimate environment, and it gives me the flexibility to work with a large group, a large celebration, or indeed a very small one. Now, a completely different take on the religious building, if you like, or a building where faith practices happen, is the Vestry Hall in Sheffield, which is inhabited by the Israq Somali Community Association. This is a group that has been practicing their community activity and their faith services for some 30 years in the community. They were tenants of this building that was owned by the local authority. Former Vestry Hall, it's a Grade 2 listed building, from 1857. But the local authority wanted to get rid of it, really. They were a bit tired of looking after it. It was a bit of a problematic building. And the community association, ISRAC, said, well, we'll take it on. And we want to keep it in the heart of the community. We want to keep it available for our faith practices, but also all of our community activities. We want to keep it as a safe haven for our Muslim community here in Sheffield. We wanted to be that safe space for our Somali community, but we also wanted to be a place where people can come and meet with our communities, our Somali culture and our Muslim faith, in a safe space that feels open to everybody. Now, there is a bit of a challenge. It's a building that needs some work. And we've been working with them to use design to help them think about, well, what is the potential of this building? How can you make it a building that works for you and your community? And we brought them on a design training course that we do and had them actually build a model of their building, which at first they gasped at and said, oh, we couldn't possibly do that. It's too hard. But actually, in building this model and in really exploring the spaces, they started to understand its potential. And I think the great thing about design is it unlocks potential. Good design unlocks potential and does it well. Here's them building it. And then they used this model, they developed it further with a group of students from Sheffield University to start to talk to local people about the building. They're at the beginning of their journey, but they are using a process of design and a process of rethinking and reimagining this building that they're taking over as a way of connecting and reaching out with a community, of inviting different communities into theirs, but also of mixing and mingling and connecting. And I think this is a really interesting time for the potential of faith buildings to do just that, to create spaces for people to connect and come together in different ways. I end on just one of my favourite anecdotes of the places that we've been working with. This is the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. It's a former Roman Catholic church, and a group took it on. The local Triratna Buddhist community in Sheffield needed a space, and they took on this building. And one of the real moments of tension in the community was over the Buddha in the belfry, which one day I will write a short story with that title. I think it's just such a lovely collection of words together. But it actually makes a really important point about our connection with religious buildings, even if they're not our own. People of the local community were pleased that this building was being used again. It had sat empty. But the notion of a Buddha being placed in a Catholic belfry and the iconography of it, what it represented, was a little frightening to people. And particularly frightening was when people didn't know what it would look like. They imagined very brightly coloured, enormous statues of the Buddha going up in the belfry. And actually, when they had a conversation about it, they realised, oh, it's actually a rather discreet and rather beautiful sculpture that sits quite beautifully in the belfry. But the conversation hadn't happened at the right time. So there's something about respecting both people's preconceptions and ideas about how they react and interact with faith buildings, but also simply having conversations about what we share, what we don't share, but how they can come together. Thank you.
So I completely failed to keep the panel to time. But I just thought they were all so kind of interesting that it was worth it. So what we're going to do is we'll take kind of 5 or 6 minutes of just points, questions from the floor, try and take as many people as we can, be as quick as you can, and then I'll invite the panel to come back and make one point.
Julian Bowery, thank you very much for inspiring me with the beautiful designs of modern churches. I go to a Gothic cathedral, and it's great to be reminded that actually there are different ways to worship than in English Gothic cathedrals. But equally, in that cathedral, St. Albans Cathedral, then I do very much feel, when participating in services, both very close to God by being in that space, but it's also lovely to see the space being used for the St. Albans Fashion Show, music concerts, a whole range of other things as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm James Walters. I'm chaplain at the LSE and director of our new multi-faith centre there. And we heard primarily about buildings for particular faith communities, but increasingly we're seeing in airports and other public buildings the required requirements for shared space. And I wonder how architecture can help facilitate that interfaith interaction.
My name is Kim Wilkie, and you haven't actually spoken about the spaces around places of worship, particularly cemeteries. And given the pressure on burial space and how many faiths are combined in cemeteries and the opportunity for celebration and contemplation in those, it'd be interesting to hear what you think.
Well, I do hope one of you chooses that question to answer. It's fascinating. Yep, and then there's two more hands there.
Hi, my name is Noura Saiz, and I'm wondering, the examples you showed were all contemporary interpretations of ancient religions, and I'm wondering about world most recent religions and how their architectural examples come into play. An example that comes to mind is the Baha'i faith, where they reinterpret the relationship between worship and service and have their own architectural elements as well.
And also, of course, there are new non-religious, like Sunday Assembly, for example, which are bringing people together for kind of non-religious collective acts, which is really interesting. Yes.
I'm Caroline Newman on behalf of the Lettering Arts Trust, and I'm just picking up on the point about cemeteries and other spaces, but would love a comment from you on the use of craftsmanship in maintaining our contemporary architecture and bringing the older crafts into play into the modern environment.
Great, that sounds like another event rather than, but anyway, we'll think about that. And then here,
Gillian Ashmore from the Quaker community. I wondered about the relationship between the architect and decision takers in the different religions. Has that proved a difficulty, and does it stand in the way of new ideas coming to the fore?
Very good. And then there was another one here.
I'm Jennifer Sturrock. I'm a fashion designer. I'm wondering about the idea of beauty and that essence of a transcending vehicle, and how important you think or don't think that is in spaces that are for faith.
Good. So, like, on, we'd like that answer on a very important, not important, 0 to 10 scale. So, just going to say 6. Beauty's important. 6 or 3 or no. I'm being flippant, of course. Right. Okay. That was a brilliant set of questions, and the panel have got 2 minutes each to respond to them. Perhaps we'll kind of go. Well, you've just spoken, so actually, we'll start with Lizzie. Lizzie, do you want to pick a couple of those questions?
Yeah. Cemeteries. We have at our place a small cemetery, 2/3 of an acre, our total site, including the building that sits on it, and we have 5,472 people buried there. We have our own catacombs. We have a complete burial register. We're available for genealogical research. People come and sit out there and have their lunch, a great venue for local office workers. I agree entirely with the idea that the cemetery is a great place for meditation about the shortness of our lives and what the hell are we going to do with them. And then, secondly, the decision takers. Well, of course, I'm in the House of Lords where there aren't any. having sat until 11 o'clock last night through discussions about Brexit and being pressed in tomorrow, it's a bumper day tomorrow, 2 years, we're told, of no decisions being taken, very little information being fed to us, decisions offered to us on a plate at the end of the day. So I invite them all to come to church where we equip them to make decisions and to think about ultimate realities and the well-being of the whole of humankind. So I want to do a huge population transposition from the hallowed halls of Sir Charles Barry's House of Lords to George Dance the Younger's space on the City Road where I work most of my time.
Fantastic. Sophia?
I'd like to come in as well on the notion of cemetery because we visited a beautiful church up near Durham, St. Michael and All Angels, where they recognised that the cemetery and the landscape around their church and cemetery was a beautiful, calm, reflective space. And they have created a whole programme called Breathing Space, which is all about stepping into that space for mindfulness, for reflection, but that it's open to absolutely everyone. They have a wonderful sign there saying, open to everyone, even dog walkers, which I love.
The other thing I touch on very quickly is the notion of beauty. And I would add to beauty delight. And I would say in architecture, it's an essential ingredient anywhere. If we don't have beauty, if we don't have delight. Beauty is, in a sense, personal in many ways. Delight is instinctive and natural. And if a place delights us, then it's doing its job design-wise.
Can I ask about awe? Where do you stand on awe?
Where do I stand on awe? I think awe has its place for some people, but that it's not as necessary, in my mind, as delight.
Very good. Delight versus awe. That'll be a future RSA yes. event. Well, I think we'll...
I think an interesting challenge that we have is that many faiths take place behind closed doors. And in some regards, we're a little fearful of what happens behind these closed doors. And what intrigues me about the observation about exteriorizing faith and exploiting spaces around places of worship is that it breaks down these barriers. And I'm fascinated by opportunities for different faiths to, I suppose, really celebrate all their different activities a little bit more openly by stepping outside the front door. I mean, as an architect, just to answer the second question about beauty, well, in this particular context, yes, you do search, hopefully, for beauty, but in the types of transformative spaces which you hope people are inspired, I think there are qualities of stillness and repose and a kind of a mute quality, which I think is more, in some regards, hopefully they're beautiful, but actually that's the harder thing. And I think stillness in this frenetic world in which we live with so much information, that feeling that most sacred spaces offer, which is just a moment to stop the world and just dwell for a while, that's to me a slightly more significant and elusive quality to find in sacred spaces.
I'm really sorry about this because I know I'm running out of time, but I'm abusing my position as chair. Can you, or maybe John, answer the question, how is this conversation affected by the emergence of kind of secular cathedrals, as it were, the you know, whether it's monstrous buildings in the City of London or huge football stadia or whatever, the scale of non-religious architecture. I mean, of course, if you go back historically, all the big, amazing buildings were religious buildings, and now they're standing side by side with these others.
I think Lewis Mumford, the great architectural critic, he said that for 2,000 years, architecture was the design of one room. You know, architecture was a concern to, you know, signify all those kind of faith issues that are at the heart of most great religions. But this, I suppose, the investment has been dislodged in our cities by a concern to create other temples of worship. It's inevitable. I mean, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but as I tried to allude to, I think we have to search for mechanisms and means to actually kind of give significance and respect to a deep need for people to find and actually come to terms with profound issues that are not commercial in some regards. And I'm not saying we should tax all these developments to create that type of space, but it's a significant and real need that we have in society, and it's diminishing.
Thank you. John?
I'll be very quick, and I'll try not to be too flippant, but with cemeteries, I'm going to go back to my dear lost friend Irvine. Well, Irvine would probably find a way of building over a cemetery and protecting and retaining it. So, you know, cemeteries take huge areas of land, and there is possibly a way of thinking about how, whilst respecting those places, to somehow find a way of using them more effectively. And I was in Brooklyn recently and saw that was happening, one of the great cemeteries there. The second thing was that in terms of religion. I mean, I went to the school in the west of Scotland, which almost killed any interest in religion in the west coast of Scotland, being brought up in a Protestant community, which put me off religion for about 50 years, until I remember we were bidding for a project in Italy for the headquarters for Max Mara, and I went into church and prayed, and we won the commission, so I thought, well, this is it. I usually take my kids with me for site visits.
And we did win it.
And we did win it. Of course we won. I said, you know, I haven't asked you for much. You know, please, Lord. You don't know. And what? He heard my prayers.
Let me ask on behalf of the rest of the room, how often is this tactic borne fruit?
Well, I've given away my secret, but it happens. It's and the third thing about beauty, and I you know, I suppose, and I sort of try to emphasise a little bit what I was saying, is that for me, multi-faith, multi-use, multifunctional, multi-faith, non-denominational spaces are the ones that I get most excited about. When you talk about beauty, I think one of our most beautiful projects, funnily enough, is a little school we built in Malawi. We took the DFID budget, Department for International Development, $25,000, £18,000. They were building horrible schools for kids in Malawi and Rwanda, horrible, airless, dark spaces. And with Arup, our engineering partner, we designed a beautiful school with a split roof, 5 teaching spaces, 2 external, 2 regular teaching spaces, and it was the space in between, and maybe it's going back to what Leslie was saying, the space in between was essentially the gap. We pulled the 2 buildings apart, and the space in between became a place where the parents of the kids who had been taught were taught by looking into the class environments that their children were being taught in. Unbelievable, brought even for somebody like me tears to my eyes that the parents were being taught. Secondly, it became a space for health workers for community medicine, and it became a sort of non-denominational place for prayer. I don't think it's a particularly beautiful building, but my God, I think in terms of inspiring me, it was everything that I thought a building should be. In terms of, to me, it's beautiful. It's very basic in its construction, but it says everything about what I think is important in life. Thank you. I wasn't serious, actually, what I said about the cemeteries. I thought I would get a laugh, but I didn't get a laugh. I didn't actually mean that. I hope you know that, Matthew, for the record.
I think you died on your feet. anyway, thank you for that. I want to thank AMA and Hague Security Limited for their generous support for tonight's event, so thank you for making it happen. It's been a brilliant conversation. I don't know much. My sense is, I don't know much about faith and architecture, and I suspect there's a lot of people in the room who know a great deal about it, and people like me who don't know much. And I think what's been fantastic is it's been an equally rich conversation for those of us who know not much, and for those of you who know a great deal, and that is down to our fantastic panel. So please join me in thanking them.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.